Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Talk about the VOD and the silver screen. Kevin and Tom and Joe know all there is to know, from masterpieces to deep fried tacos. And if the movie sucks, you might hear them say, there's no telling where the guys will take you. Get ready for a spoiler. Won't say it twice, cause we already warned you. Better watch out.
Broadcasting from the lush but not lavish studios located in the basement of the O'Keefe Institute for Advanced Film Snarkitude, this is Real Spoilers, episode 612, Psycho. People for years have been asking for my ex-wife to be a guest on the show.
I was going to make a Tom ex-wife joke, but I was like, yeah, I'm going to stay in my lane.
I wanted to do like the music, but it's weird because with Halloween or Friday the 13th, I could tell you something. I mean, with Psycho, I could go like,
this is a Psycho theme.
But I couldn't.
Oh, you couldn't replicate it?
I could go, like I could tell you, but with Psycho, I don't know what I would say.
I mean, that's all you got is really the stabs.
Joe, what is it?
I mean, I couldn't recreate it, but if you were to
that's
play
what
it,
I'm yeah. Exactly, that was my point. I didn't say there's no music. I said I don't know what it is.
So I guess let's go around the virtual table and everyone can introduce themselves.
This is Joe.
This is Kevin.
And this is Tom. And joining us, special guest and horror movie expert Ryan Terry is joining us. Hey Ryan, how's it going?
Hey guys, thanks so much for having me back.
We just wanted somebody that knows what they're talking about for a change.
What's happening right now?
We have no one here that likes horror, so it's great that Ryan is here.
So real quick, shameless plugs before we jump in. Don't forget, we're available on Apple Podcasts. You can go there, rate, review, subscribe. While you're there, be sure and subscribe so you never miss an episode. And, of course, check out our Facebook page, facebook.com/realspoilers. While you're there, like the page, join the group. The group, if you're hunting for it, is called the League of Show Sharers. And if you want to become a real-life League of Show Sharers, all you got to do is share an episode. And here's what you need to do. Share an episode. I guess I set it up that way, so it was really redundant. But
it's in the name.
Yeah. So people who were kind enough to share an episode this week, Gabriel Lugo, Ralph Tribble, Travis Tewitt, Librarian Cynthia, Julianne Jordan, Heather Sachs, Tammy Sherman Powers. And then I just take them in the order they come in, so this just happens. Chris Sanders, Chris Falls, Chris Williams, Ron Johnson, Chris Magic Man. So, and then going over to the Twitterverse, we have Mike and Oscar, Nerd Adonis, Colby Mack, Matt Naglia, Ryan Terry. Now, you might get some pushback from Brad Hyen here because you're on the episode and I'm including you in League of Show Shares. So just to recap, the Brad Hyen rule is you don't get credit for sharing the episode you were on. So you shared an episode you weren't on, but now you're on, so you do get credit. That's we went to the judges, which is me, and that's how I rolled. So, also, Forza Crowd, James from Geek to Me Radio, Aaron White from Feel and Film, and Invasion of the Remake. So thank you guys very much for sharing the show. We really appreciate it. And, of course, our Patreon, patreon.com/realspoilers, where for $5 a month you get all sorts of bonus content. And it helps us out tremendously, and we're greatly appreciative. So there we go. Psycho.
Hit the music, Joe.
Yeah.
We Yeah.
You know, it's funny, like, we're talking about how, like, we don't know the music, but Alfred Hitchcock, like, thought this movie was a total turd until it was scored, and then he was like, oh, okay, maybe I got something here.
They did that to Halloween when they showed the ACADS, like the initial cut of Halloween. They're like, this isn't scary. And then Carpenter's like, hold on a second.
It'll get
And then
there.
Quickly wrote the theme.
Yeah.
And then put the music over. They're like, oh, now it works.
And on the flip side of that, from a genre standpoint, when Woody Allen first premiered Take the Money and Run, he was using like a scratch track for music. And people were like, this isn't funny. It's sad. And then Henry Mancini came in and was like, hang on. Bloop, bloop, bloop. And then now they're like, here, now it's funny. And it
like,
was.
Oh, that works.
Yeah.
Here, this is the thing. I don't think this movie, we don't need to go beat by beat with this movie. I think everybody has seen this, whether you like horror, whether you don't like horror, this film kind of goes past like the horror genre.
Right. There are some movies that exceed the genre. So like you might not like horror movies, but if you like movies, you should like Psycho.
Yes.
You might not like Westerns, but you're still probably going to like The Searchers or
I encounter that in the world of academia because I'm the only horror fanboy in my department at the University of Tampa, although we do have another faculty member who enjoys fantasy and sci-fi, so some of the stuff she likes does
a little crossover
what end I like, but one of the things that I find very common throughout grad school and then in teaching is that, you know, Psycho gets shown in like all these film studies classes, even if the professor, you know, may not be a horror fan, and most aren't. It's a little unusual to be like total fanboy on the academic level in that particular genre.
Yeah.
And so, but that film gets shown because it is not only a great horror film, it's just a great film, period.
Right.
And
it really is.
And arguably the shower scene is the single most studied and famous scene in all of cinema.
Yeah.
So
and here's an interesting thing. So I have a stepdaughter who loves horror movies. She'll be 14 today, actually. And
happy birthday.
Oh, a happy birthday.
And so we watched all three of these together and
so Psycho 2 and 3 or 2, 3, 4?
1 through 3.
1 through 3.
So,
okay.
Yeah. And so I also my 16-year-old son, who is not a movie buff at all. And so I was just kind of curious. I know that's how they rebel.
Give it time. He'll come around.
Yeah.
It'll be all right.
And so like he'll watch a movie, but he doesn't like have a passion for it on any level. And so and they were not bored. They did not bitch about Psycho. Like sometimes when you go back to movies, I mean that movie's 60 years old, right?
Yeah.
And so
it just celebrated its 60th anniversary because the Cinemark at Universal showed the special 60th anniversary uncut edition.
Ooh.
And it really had I didn't have a stopwatch with me, but realistically we're probably talking about 5 minutes of extra footage, no extra scenes, but you spend a little bit more time in Marion's bedroom when she's packing up, you spend a little bit more time in the there was that one, then there was at the swamp, you spend a little bit more time at the swamp, and so there are there was several extra minutes, probably about 5, and so it's like, wow, I get to watch, you know, like parts of this film that I've never seen before for the very first time on the big screen. And I don't have a huge Blu-ray collection. I do buy them every now and again, but that's one that the 60th anniversary edition is one I would like because it allowed some scenes that were a little on the shorter side to breathe a little more. And I think it worked really well. And speaking of first time watching it, when I showed it to my class this semester, most of my students had never seen it. I think only one or two had. And those that had never seen it before were completely blown away. And so these are 18, 19, 20-year-olds, because I teach an 8 a.m. class, so it's usually the freshmen that did that one.
They don't know
I'm surprised
yet.
I'm there at 8 o'clock in the morning. But they absolutely loved it, and I half expected them to be like, yeah, because you know some of the other stuff I've shown, you know, a handful of people like, and others be like, yeah, whatever. But like unanimously, you know, this group which had never seen it before, like, did not see anything coming. And yeah. I watch.
Well, it's basically the Rosetta Stone for modern horror.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely it is.
The other thing that I think is really neat about it, though, too, is that when you think horror, you think that it's going to get into the tropes of horror. And this movie really doesn't just fall into a bunch of tropes because it was so innovative and so, you know, one of the originals.
They didn't exist yet.
Yeah, and for...
The tropes, yeah, they weren't in existence.
Right, so
this created the tropes.
So through a modern eye, you're thinking, oh, it's, you know, if you're not that into horror, which I wasn't at the time even more than I was now, but I'm like, okay, it's a classic, I gotta see it, and then you watch it, but really, horror doesn't even start for 45 minutes, you know, like yeah. what you would think of as horror, because Hitchcock was the master of suspense, and all the building up that he does, and you get to know Marion, you get to know the characters and the situation and what she's dealing with, and so by the time you get to anything that would be considered horror, you know, in that genre, you're really halfway through the movie, and so you get this great film with great shots and acting. It's a beautiful film, and it's so interesting. And then it takes the flip. It flips that switch at the Bates Motel in the shower scene. And then you're on the run. And it's just like this tour de force of performances. And it really changes gears, but in the best way. And so I think that's why people may set up their expectations like, oh, it's old. If people don't like watching old movies and it's horror, I'm not that into it. But this is a classic for a reason. And it's absolutely a film that every time I watch it, I'm like, it's a masterpiece.
Yeah, like even if you go in, you know, knowing it's a horror movie, and really at this right, point, how right. can you not? But like it lulls you into this false sense of security where you're like, oh, especially like now that it's an old movie, it kind of works to its advantage. You're like, oh, okay, it's an old movie, and what was a horror back then isn't the same thing as a horror now, and it's going to be this girl on the run, and okay, and like I don't really know why they call it that, but I guess it was the 60s, and holy shit, they just stabbed her in the face, you know?
Well, not even that, like it's Janet Leigh. Like she's a massive name at this point.
Right.
And Hitchcock kills her in the first 30 minutes. And
yeah.
You know, it's
and maybe you could help me with that. I've never spent a lot of time looking into Janet Leigh's filmography beyond, like, you know, the couple of times that she and Jamie Lee have gotten to share the screen together in Halloween H2O, and I think maybe one other time. And Janet Leigh was a guest on Murder, She Wrote in an episode.
Correct.
But I don't know a lot about her filmography up to this point, beyond knowing she was the big name, and that's why it was so shocking. But, you know, maybe briefly you can describe for me, like, how or why, because I've not taken the time to really look into it.
She was an MGM chick, so she was in, like, Little Women and the original Angels in the Outfield, The Naked Spur, stuff like that.
There was one before JGL?
Yeah.
Yeah, shocking. Oh. I know. She was also in Touch of Evil.
She was also married to Tony Curtis.
Yeah, and Touch of Evil would have been...
Oh, I did know that, yeah.
Yeah, and Touch of Evil would have been 2 years before this, so...
Okay.
So, I mean, yeah, she was... I don't know that, you know, she could open a movie, as we would say today, but she was definitely a name, you know, and been in...
And probably
and
the only
stuff.
Name. I mean, you had Vera Miles, but, I mean, out of everybody, Anthony Perkins was not a name. And
he was mostly a stage actor before.
He was,
Psycho.
Yeah.
He's so good. I just have to say.
I'm glad you said that, Kevin, because it is a crime that he never really got his due post-Psycho.
Well,
yeah, he never really made it out. Like, he got in that role. And I don't know, maybe I'm speaking out of turn, but I think he was in the closet.
Yes, he was. He ends up married, like...
That's where we get Oz Perkins, director of Black Coat's Daughter.
Yeah,
that's right.
And I think Oz Perkins is in the second one briefly. Like you see a reflection
really?
Of.
Oh, is that right?
You see a reflection of Norman Bates as a child.
You do,
and that's
door.
Oz Perkins. But yeah, like from what I was reading, like he didn't have his first heterosexual experience until he was 39, and then it was with Victoria Principal. So like. Man, you just went straight to PhD level stuff. Yeah. Like that's Victoria Principal.
If you're gonna do it, I mean, I guess you're
yeah,
gonna go,
like it's like
you're
that's,
gonna do it right. I guess
that's what it took. You know, like it, you
which
had to
honestly
be Victoria
makes
Principal.
Sense.
Yeah, but you know? But yeah. So and then he ends up married, and then an odd little footnote apropos of nothing, and then his wife was quite a bit younger, and then she ended up dying in one of the planes on 9/11.
Oh,
really?
Yeah. So
that's crazy.
Wow.
Yeah, it's just like to suck the oxygen out of the room
yeah,
every once in a while.
But I will say, like, he, even when we get to 2 and 3, which 2 and 3 have their place, but in this one, like, it's, he's almost doing a Christopher Reeve before Christopher Reeve did it. Like, he's able to be these two different characters and make you believe in both of them. I mean, even at the end when he's smiling at the camera, you're just like, oh yeah,
sure,
he is a whack job.
Oh, such a creepy smile.
He's got almost Jim Carrey face. Like, his face just kind of looks very pliable.
Well, it is, because I will tell you what. So when I was watching this, and I wanted to do a Twitter thread, I didn't have the time, and I wanted to do some high-quality screen caps. But I got him looking like Ryan Reynolds.
I could see that.
He looked...
Yeah.
Who else was it? There were a few different people where I'm like, I could match him to looking like different actors. And so it's interesting you say that, Joe, because I think he does have one of those faces where he has so many different expressions that he can manipulate them. And it was amazing. Oh, Jimmy Fallon at some points when, you know.
Okay.
I thought, to me, he reminded me a lot of a young Jimmy Stewart. Like, I could see, had it not been for Psycho, him going down the path of being that sort of a leading man, but
I mean, he had the look to be in that same breath.
He's a handsome
dude. Aged very well.
Mm-hmm. He did. Yeah.
I couldn't believe that watching the other ones, you know, how they were filmed so much later. And I mean, yeah, he was still in good shape. I mean, he looked healthy, and he, like you said, he aged very well. But with this film, he's so good at, like, what Joe was talking about with the mirror, the two personalities. And when he flips that switch because of those facial, the way that he's able to act with his face and the way that the character reacts to things, it really reminds you of how great of an actor he is. And that's unfortunate that he was more typecast.
Yeah, because there's so much subtext to the performance. Like, even when he's like normal, like,
yeah,
you can,
right
you can see that he's not normal, but it's
not normal.
But it's not so suppressed or like, because if he goes too far that direction where, like, you don't believe that the other character couldn't see it, right? So, like, you still believe that this other person, because they're not looking for it like we are, and so
sure.
You know, so it's like you see it as a viewer, but you still believe that the other characters wouldn't see it.
He seems suave and confident when he's, especially in the beginning, when he's not rattled by the police and the private detectives coming around and the people coming around. He's very calm. I think he's very much like a, who is it? Is it Ted Bundy? Who is the...
Ted Bundy was the handsome...
He's very much in that realm of, like, he's a handsome guy. He seemed very kind of like funny and able to carry a conversation. And so I was thinking of it like, if you talked to this guy and you didn't know who Norman Bates was, that you would be fooled by his act.
Sure.
Because he does have that confidence. And it doesn't go the other direction, like Tom said. If he was like this very shy, introverted, kind of like didn't talk a lot, it would come off more creepy. But him as Norman, before he's spooked especially, does not come off in that way. So it is a flip of the switch that turns him into the other personality, and he balances that very well.
In real life, typically serial killers are pretty charming, right? Like that's how they get you. Like, if they were these creepy, weird-looking dudes, you know, that...
I mean,
you
Charlie
know,
Manson.
Yeah.
Unless you're Buffalo Bill. Buffalo Bill was, he was just
well,
really,
Buffalo Bill, really, when he wasn't doing the dance, I mean, was a handsome dude.
But they need to lure you in. So, like,
they
you,
do, yeah.
Yeah, like, that's how they do it.
Well, to Tom's point real quick,
yeah,
is just that I wonder if having to hide his sexuality added another layer to being able to hide that. That's you know what I mean, like,
no, I,
in his real life world, having to hide his sexuality probably brought something different to that role that I didn't think about until you just said that.
Yeah,
where he has to hide that psychotic side as,
like,
well,
the dark side,
without knowing that he was, I mean, well, I take that back, he probably did know that he was hiding something, but not realizing what he was bringing to the role. So, yeah, we could breeze through it. So we're introduced to Janet Leigh, played or Marion Crane, played by Janet Leigh. Pretty simple. She works at a bank. She's not really content with her life. She's got a boyfriend, Sam Loomis, Obviously, we now know.
Is that a Halloween? Did he
Halloween
get that in?
Yes. Yeah, okay. Yes. And then
yeah,
Wes,
yeah, that's where Dr. Loomis gets his
name. I figured.
And then Wes Craven took the same name, and Billy Loomis from Scream.
I was
going to
say, there's a Loomis
after.
In all the in these different movies.
Yeah,
okay.
There is. So that's the thing, is like Psycho paved the way for everything.
Yeah, it's so iconic.
Wes Craven, Carpenter, all those guys, to the point where I think Steve Miner ended up putting Janet Lee in Halloween H2O as Jamie Lee Curtis's secretary, mm-hmm. and she's driving, when
the
you see her,
car.
She's driving the same car inside.
And they get the music, too. There's a little bit of the Psycho score as she's getting into
and
it.
Just,
so I,
a real quick footnote for that car. It's the same car that that the Cleavers drove on Leave It to Beaver. Yeah.
Maybe it was
like
their
the
same
car.
It was all shot on the all
you know,
on
that's what I mean. It's the exact same car. Not make
a
model. It's the exact same car.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That is so cool.
Yeah. And there's also another movie. There's a Humphrey Bogart movie. I think it's The Desperate Hours. That's actually shot. It's really weird to watch. Someone who watched Leave It to Beaver. The whole movie takes place. He's like an escaped convict who kidnaps a family within their own home. But the home is the Cleaver's home.
The Cleaver's house?
And, yeah. And so, and it was made they use the same car again. It's Ward's car in the driveway. And so it's like, if you watch Leave It to Beaver, you're like, this whole movie's taking place in the Cleaver's house.
It's actually,
you know,
it's in the same world.
Yeah. It's really weird. So.
Yeah.
I guess that's why they got the house.
The Bays Motel is
on
right.
sale.
So yeah. So she's not really content. She's got this boyfriend, Sam, who I can't tell. Do they ever explain why they're sneaking around?
I don't know if it had to do with something at the time, the fact that he was going through his divorce.
He was married,
wasn't he?
Yeah.
He's either married or going through his divorce.
Well, he's paying alimony, so he's
divorced.
That's
what I'm saying. Like,
yeah.
He's paying alimony, so he's divorced. So
I don't think they're sneaking around. I think he travels, and I think that they don't live together, and so they meet up at these hotels on her lunch hours. Like,
yeah, she's in L.A. and he's in Fairvale, and so they're in different cities.
So they meet in Phoenix?
No.
She's in Phoenix. That's right.
Yeah.
He lives in Fairvale,
and so they,
which is just outside of Los Angeles.
Yeah, and so they have to meet. Apparently, there's in another version of the script, or maybe it's the book, they met on a cruise. That's why that's how they know each other,
single
but they don't live in the same city.
So, and that's the thing.
Too bad
they
didn't meet on the Orient Express because Anthony Perkins was in the original.
That's right.
So they could have met there.
But I think in the book, the description of Norman is not anywhere near Anthony Perkins.
No, he's like short and fat and weird looking, and it's like everything.
Hitchcock had to fight to get Perkins into that,
which is
role.
Such a better choice than having again, if it's obvious, if you go to this hotel and there's a creepy dude there, you're gonna be like, oh, a creeper. But he gets to be in that serial killer type role where he's so charming and handsome and doesn't let anything on, you know, as he's controlling it so well. And he doesn't even have control. I mean, as an actor, he does a great job with both, but Norman Bates doesn't. You know, he doesn't tap into that personality. It takes over him, and he becomes the other personality. So it's not even like he's trying to hide it, quote unquote. He's just, you know, he's Norman Bates until he's not.
Until he's Norma Bates. And then it's interesting, like, I think as much as we give crap to the remake, I think the casting of Vince Vaughn is kind of brilliant. Mm-hmm. Like, Vince Vaughn has that kind of, like, dopey quality, but we've seen before. If you've never seen, I think it's like Cell Block 66, where he turns on a dime. And obviously, there's this new one coming out called Freaky, which is the
I can't wait for that. Looks so fun.
I think the casting of Vince Vaughn is very interesting, and that's one of the high points of that movie.
Is he Norman Bates?
I'm actually in terms of the Gus Van Sant remake. I've never come down really hard on the casting choices. I like the cast. I don't like anything else about it, but I think that Anne Hesh, William H. Macy, Julianne Moore, Vince Vaughn, they were in Lost World together and Psycho, and they had to have been filmed at the same time or, you know, one right after the other, which I thought was kind of which I thought was really neat. And then, of course, Julianne Moore in that same year was also Boogie Nights. So she was like...
She was on fire.
She was on fire that year. But I like the casting choices in the remake.
It's a dumb move.
It's unnecessary. He made a shot-for-shot remake because he thought, you know, people don't want to watch black and white. You know, like, I can't change it, but hey, now we can update it in color. Yeah. It's like, why? Why would you do that?
I sent a picture.
He really was the Vince Vaughn choice. He did very well. And I feel he went into it in terms of the performance with the right approach and with the right heart, because it shows. I think he did a very good job.
I sent a picture to the guys. Is the cop that they cast in the remake is James Remar, and if you look at the cop is side by side with the cop that finds Mary on the side of the road, they look identical. Like, it's
because the casting, because the movie is an identical shot for shot remake. So
James Remar looks just like that cop. So she works for like a real estate agent, and there's a high roller that comes in. It's going to drop like $40,000, which is $40,000,
about $350,000 in today's money.
Well, I was going to say in the remake, they jack it up to $400,000 because they're just like, that's not a thing. Marion Crane's boss is kind of like that. We can't do a transaction like that. Go put that money in. Tells Marion to go put the money in the safety deposit box. So Marion decides to hell with it and just goes on the run. She gets herself packed up. She takes the cash. There is the cameo of Hitchcock in this movie. Is as soon as Marion comes back into the building, Hitchcock is standing outside the window.
It's before the guy comes in.
Is that what it is?
Cowboy hat standing outside. But think of her work schedule. She probably got to work at 9. It's a long lunch hour, so I'm going to guess it's at least an hour and a half, if not 2 hours. So she goes to lunch at, we'll say, noon. She gets back at 2. Then she has her headache.
And then she leaves.
15. And then she leaves. I mean, what a work schedule.
Yeah. And the guy's just like, yeah, that works. Sure, go ahead. Get out of here.
Meanwhile, the other secretary.
Yeah, she's been there all day. No one's
Hitchcock's.
Yeah, that's Hitchcock's daughter. Yeah.
No one's hitting on her. It's like, she's not having
it. I know, and he gives her the line, basically.
Her wedding ring.
Which is a good line. Yeah. I do like that line. Where she's like, oh, no, it's the wedding ring. I'm like, or it's Janet Leigh. But whatever.
But imagine giving that line to your daughter. That's a little mean. You're going to be the ugly one. I got a great line for you.
Yeah, you'll be fine. Don't even worry.
So she goes on the run with the money, and she's tired. So
sleeps on the side of the road.
Yeah. Well, she pulls a Butch from Pulp Fiction, where her boss kind of like walks in front of her car.
Oh yeah.
And he's like, they both look at each other. I'm just like, you know that
her boss had a ball gag in his mouth. And he's like,
Before we leave Phoenix, though, real quick, I was out in Phoenix in 2017 for my sister's college graduation, and I got there before my family because I wanted to take myself on a psycho tour of the city. And so I found all the locations as close as I could get in 2017 to where Hitchcock would have set the camera and framed each of the shots. And I actually found the Barrister building in real life is what stood in for the hotel building. And there's some high rises where the camera would have been back at the time. But I went into one of the high rises to the management floor of the building. I said, hey, you got this, not balcony or whatever, a viewing deck or whatever, like at this part of the building. I said, but this is like Hitchcock would have been on a smaller building on this block shooting this direction. And I really want to recapture that shot. So I went through downtown Phoenix recapturing those shots. And you can actually get pretty close today and framing many of those same shots.
That's
that
pretty awesome.
That you get the Phoenix skyline. It was cool. I had a blast. And so my family thought I was a little weird, but like, what? This is fun.
I had a blast. Yeah. But if you went hunting, no one would think twice of it, right?
Yeah, like right.
Yeah.
Yeah, but because you're trying to find some cool locations, you're the weird one.
It's like, right. This is like I always say, donuts for breakfast. That's cake.
Yeah.
I mean, somehow we justify, pizza for breakfast is weird. I know you do it, Joe. Don't have to comment. But I'm just saying, people are like,
I've had pizza for breakfast.
I know. Yeah. But what I'm saying is people are like, you got to have cereal or donuts for breakfast. But if you eat pizza or if you have fried chicken left over for breakfast, it's weird. But you can eat.
Hey, chicken and waffles. That is like crap.
But you can eat cake every day for breakfast and no one will say anything because it's in a circle.
Well, your doctor will, but you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. So she goes on the run, and as she's on her way, she realizes she can't make it. So in the rain, so she pulls over, she sees the lights of the Bates Motel. She pulls over. And we're introduced to Norman, and it's like he's got such a, I think the lankiness comes into play much like in 2 and 3. Like in this one, he's just kind of tall and skinny. There's something about the way that he aged and the way his body changed in 2 and 3 that make him look lankier and like bonier. Maybe he just lost weight.
Just a thin guy. I think that's how he's built.
He's a very thin guy. Yeah. And I guess that's true. He's a young guy in this one, so I'm sure he's probably in fairly good shape. So he's filled out a little bit more. But we're introduced to Norman, and he's kind of odd, but still kind of sweet. Like it's tough when you have Janet Leigh walk into a scene, and he has the right reaction. Like he's immediately kind of like, "Whoa,
yeah."
You know, there's given where the hotel is, he probably doesn't see a woman that looks like that very often.
He hardly sees anyone in general.
I guess that's true. Sees anybody except for his wrinkled corpse of a mother.
Oh, that's not a very nice way to describe her, Joe.
I mean, if you want to talk about Olivia Hussey, we can do that because she's in Part 4. So it's a completely normal relationship. First meeting, like he's a little awkward, which makes sense. But there's nothing sinister yet. I will say one of the shots that as I watched it this second time that I thought was really interesting is Norman sitting in the back parlor with the stuffed owl over his shoulder. Mm-hmm. And like owls are natural predators. So I was like, that's kind of a brilliant shot. Like I never noticed that until just now.
There's a whole bird motif throughout the entire film from the taxidermied birds there in the parlor. You have the picture of the birds on that falls down when
her name is Crane.
Yeah, right.
Her name is Crane. Yeah. So we whole motif of birds as well as eyes, and the motif of birds and eyes goes together because it's like bird's eye view of Phoenix, the eye of the shower, the eye of the shower drain, the cop's eyes, mother's ever watchful eye. So you have this motif of eyes, and we often associate eyes with birds because birds, the very nature of their being makes them have this sort of observant nature to them and being able to watch everything. And so I love how we play around with this manifestation of the idea of eyes, and we manifest it through birds and then through framing of different shots and the great match cut later on in the shower. And so so the bird's really, really important, in particular, the one you just mentioned with the owl, because they're nocturnal. This is happening at night, you know, and they're predatory, and they're largely, I can't think of the right word, but they're, we don't see them very often. And so they're there, they're everywhere. Every region of the country has their version of an owl. We don't see them. They're just kind of always lurking in those liminal spaces.
They're very, very sneaky.
Just off to the side.
They are various. But they're also, I think they're birds that are natural predators, but we never think of them that way. Mm-hmm. We think of them as like, they're just cute owls. You know, they're just like, you know,
they're very
the
wise.
Nighttime birds.
I don't know. If you look, they always look angry. Their eyebrows are pointed down like this. So I don't know. I mean, if you actually look at their face, they always look like they're going to kill you.
But you never think that they have like the sharpest talons or things, you know, things of that nature.
Maybe you don't. Don't turn your back
on
them,
I
Joe.
I guess that's true. Yeah, that's
and don't
true.
Get but, anywhere you know, near one with a lollipop. I'll tell you that.
Three.
By
three,
the way, how many
takes,
licks
apparently.
does it take? Oh, that's right. It is three, isn't it?
Three. Oh. Yeah.
Well, you only get only
one,
two, right?
One, two, and then a crunch.
It's two.
Yeah, so. It's one, two.
So, one of the things that is great in any Hitchcock film, he had some great camera angles. He really
time.
Does some amazing camera
and never
work.
An over-the-shoulder shot. And none of Hitchcock's films will you ever find an over-the-shoulder shot when two characters are in dialogue.
There you go. So, he framed things a lot like a play, mm-hmm. in a lot of ways. But what really impressed me watching this movie again and studying it is all those different camera angles, and especially the one in the house, the overhead up the stairs.
Mm-hmm.
I love that shot. And when I watched the first episode of Bates Motel and they go up the stairs and they don't do that, I'm like, who the hell directed this and who didn't do an homage to that shot? It's so stupid they didn't.
Just keep going.
That's such an iconic shot. I'm like, when they walked up the stairs, they should have introduced that because I was waiting for it. Like, that's the shot right there. But I love that how the way that he frames it, because you're in a tight space, right? In the Bates house, you're going up the stairs that kind of like immediately go up and to the left or right in that little hallway. And so it's very crowded, but the way that he does the overhead of it allows you to see it in a better way, and also it's creepier, right? Because you're watching people from overhead. You can't mm-hmm. see faces, which comes into play when you don't know who the mother is and what's going on. So it allows you to hide that and build the suspense while also be very interesting to watch. And so I enjoyed seeing all those different angles throughout the film.
And I also think in real time when this movie came out, with the whole kind of hiding the mother's faces, I think the viewer was expecting some what we would now call stunt casting. Like, they thought he had, because like on all the still shots from the set, like they had a director's chair that said Mrs. Bates on it. Like they had director's chairs with all the cast names on it, character names. And there was one that said Mrs. Bates on it, but they never would reveal who was playing her.
That's
and
cool.
So people were expecting it to be some big name when you finally saw her, and they had like leaked names of people who it might have been, and like it. And then also, if you look at the promotional shots from the film, you have pictures on the set and you see so many people, like actors from the film that are sitting in the chair that says Mrs. Bates, but you never see Anthony Perkins in that chair.
Oh, that's pretty
that's
slick.
Awesome.
Yeah.
That's
and
pretty
so
awesome.
So the individual who plays mother there in the shower scene was, it was a woman on set who was she was I forget her role on set, but it's because Anthony was shooting. He was either rehearsing for or in a Broadway show when they shot the shower scene, and so it's actually it's another woman from the set who actually plays that part.
That's crazy to think that wasn't.
I forget her role on the set. Ben Mankiewicz mentioned it on the 60th anniversary screening that I saw the other week. But it was a woman on the set who worked. She was on the crew. I just wish I could remember what she did.
Just filled in.
She filled in.
Wow.
And that house still exists, right? Like Universal still has that.
It's
house.
On the Universal tour. Like you could, when you go take the tour of the Universal lot, it's there. It's to
that's
this
so cool. I think it's, we were just talking about, I was talking about that with a buddy, and I think that and the Myers house are both like the original houses are still in existence. I think the Myers house is somewhere.
It's in Los Angeles.
Yeah, there we go. But it's just like that. Those are two very famous horror houses that still
exist. And don't forget 1428 Elm Street, which you can also visit.
That's still there, too. LA. But that's like an actual house, right?
It is,
yeah. Yeah. So just to fast forward, we all know what's going to happen. Yeah, exactly.
There you go.
Janet, I thought it was. That's the other.
I thought it was interesting the amount of detail that goes into that. What 70 seconds in the movie?
If that
to put it in perspective, they had Janet Leigh for she shot in this movie for 3 weeks. One of those weeks was the shower scene.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And that's, so I think third of her time was spent on like 60 seconds.
And I think it's 70 or 90 shots. It's something crazy. It's 70 shots, 90 shots, some just outlandish number, all for 45, 50, maybe 60. I don't even think it's a minute long.
Yeah.
But no, it's
like 45 seconds. But yet that 45 seconds is comprised of it was like 70 or 90 different takes. It's just mind blowing.
But doesn't she have a body double too?
Oh, I don't know.
I know she always contests it. She always is one of those.
She
things.
She said she didn't, but I think in later years it revealed that they did. I think that there was a stripper that they.
I'm
got.
Pretty sure. Yeah, because it was one of those things where she always said that it wasn't, but then I was like, I'm pretty sure it came out that it was. So it's weird to think that out of all that filming and everything that she wasn't even in all of it. So right.
Did you ever see the movie Hitchcock?
Which is
basically the making of this movie, mm-hmm. and it's funny that they got Scarlett Johansson to be Jennifer Jason Leigh to play Janet Leigh. And I don't remember who played. It doesn't matter. Yeah. But of course, they got one of the most beautiful women in Hollywood today to play Janet Leigh. So days go by, and we find out that Marion's sister, played by Vera Miles, has begun to worry. Like, Marion hasn't shown up.
This is the other interesting thing about this movie. Halfway through, you switch your main characters.
Yeah. And so you get rid of it.
You've got Marion Crane for the first 45, 50 minutes. Then you get the shower scene. And then it becomes about Sam Loomis and her sister, who you've never even seen the sister before this.
Who we'll get into like one and like two and three, but like Sam switches sisters pretty quick. and we'll get into that later.
It's really interesting how you switch the characters like that. And of course, the audiences were famously bait and switched. And that's why the whole you can't go into the movie after it starts thing and all that.
It changed cinema.
So it's interesting that it does that. And it works so well. Like, I mean, not having an attachment to Janet Leigh, not having her be a star of the time, whenever you watch the movie for the first time and modernize, you know, it doesn't bother you. You're just like, oh, that's interesting. But then you get the new characters and you're like, oh, wow, this movie's going in a whole different direction. And I like all the characters that you follow. I think
they're all good. Yeah. Everybody's even the smaller characters.
The Private Eye. He's good.
The Private Eye. Yeah. Vera Miles is at the police station. We find out that. So she realizes that they're trying to trace Marion's steps. So now the place where she worked, where Marion worked, has hired a private investigator.
Arbogast,
who...
Arbogast.
who, because this business is out $40,000, they want to know where it is. So
and I like how the owner of the bank, even though the cowboy guy that gave him the $40,000, you know, was at the business, gave him the money, the business owner on the phone when she's driving and they're doing that, either
like,
her,
hey, that's not my fault.
Yeah, he's like I'm not taking responsibility for this. It's like, wait a minute, I gave you at your business $400,000 and you're saying, oh, not my fault. I don't think
not
that's how that
yet.
Works.
Yeah. One, two, three, not it.
Good luck with that. I just thought that was interesting that he's like, well, I said I was worried about it, so I'm not taking responsibility.
Right. So I think Arbogast starts to like put it together. So he gets out to the hotel first, and is like, and it talks to Norman, and he's like, "Man, this is off."
Well, Norman is so charming, and he's able to pull the wool over everybody's eyes that he interacts with. But this guy, being a private detective,
he needs Arbogast.
He's able to actually pick up on these clues, and so it's nice to see.
Well,
someone
he
kind of
gets him. He gets him rattled. Like that's when the facade starts to drop, because he starts asking some pointed questions that he doesn't have answers for. Yeah.
And then Norman contradicts himself. Nobody's here in weeks. Oh, there was a couple the other day.
Yeah, right. Yeah. That's the detective work, right? So it's great to see that he picks up on those. And then he just digs deeper and deeper and deeper. And Norman starts to unravel. And he's usually so calm and collected. And you start to see him get worried and sweat. And you really see that's for the first time the characters start to act like that.
But he tries to hire the guy, and he needs help with Linen Day. So he's still willing to give him a job.
He'll stick around and do a little work.
He's doing that whole, you know, he's not protesting, him looking around. Oh, yeah, sure, follow me around, right? Like, oh, well, if he offers, then he must be innocent, and this guy's not falling for it.
No.
So Arbogast takes off, calls the sister, and just says, look, I'm going to go back up there. Something's not right. So he goes back, goes into the house, and this is the infamous scene where all of a sudden the music cue picks up, and I mean, like, it's very reminiscent of Exorcist 3 when the sheeted individual comes darting out of a corner. Again, probably a major influence from Psycho. It has to be. I don't know how it can't be. And, you know, sort of stabs Arbogast. Like, it's very I think this is one of the scenes that almost takes me out of the movie, and it's become very famous, where Arbogast kind of acts like he's falling, and they have like a screen behind him that's moving, and so like Arbogast isn't moving anywhere, but like the screen is moving.
It's great.
To look like he's falling. I mean, I don't have a problem
falling
with it,
down
it's just
the
like,
stairs with the moving screen. Oh, that's wonderful, wonderful movie making right there. It's a product of the time, but I always love that when it's like
I wanted it to happen to Robert Loggia, but that does not happen.
Robert Loggia.
So when Arbogast is killed. So now, Vera Miles and the guy that plays Sam Loomis are like, man, this guy's supposed to call us back.
Well, this guy thinks Sam Loomis is in on it because, you know, his girlfriend stole $40,000 and he starts poking around, and then he realizes.
Which makes sense.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a fair theory.
Yeah, yeah, no,
I
mean?
I would think it too. Yeah,
yeah. So he's like, hey, wait here an hour. I'll be right back. I'm going to go check, follow these leads. And so Vera Miles starts getting all worked up because she's like, he said an hour. And she's rightfully freaked out because it's her sister's
missing.
Right. And so he said he was at the Bates Motel and checking it out. And now they haven't heard from him. She's taking it upon herself to go investigate.
So finally, her and Sam drive up there and kind of act like a couple. And I take that back. They go to the sheriff's house first, mm-hmm. and the sheriff's like, stop, leave that kid alone. Like, he's been through enough. And they kind of hint that they mention the quote unquote troubles, that Norman had. We'll find out what that is later.
But they say,
actually, I don't think we find out what it is until 4,
but the psychologist gives us a bit of a,
God, does he ever.
That exposition dump at the very end.
That's true. That's true. Uses some terminology.
Of an exposition dump. But they mentioned that Arbogast was going to talk to the mother, and that's what sets the judge off. I'm
right.
Like, Mrs. Bates has been dead for 10 years or whatever.
Yeah, there's no women up there.
Was buried in a periwinkle blue dress.
Oh, lovely.
They did mention that, which I thought was, I'm like, all right, it's very specific. Like, I feel like that might come back later. Yeah. So Vera Miles and Sam, I can't think of what that character's name is.
Who's Sam? Sam's character is Sam.
No, Vera Miles.
Oh, Lila or something?
Lila.
Like?
Lila. Okay, so Lila and Sam go up to the Bates Motel. And they start their own kind of like investigation. They act like a married couple.
Yeah, they do.
Spoilers for Psycho 2. So Sam starts to poke. Like, they realize that Norman goes up to the house, and Sam starts to poke around. And Norman, again, much like that owl, sneaks in behind him and smashes Sam in the back of the head and knocks him out. And then Lila heads up to the house. And she can't find anything. She's running, you know, she sees Norman come back in the house. She's hiding in the cellar. She turns the light on in the cellar. And of course, there we see the back of Mrs. Bates. And I could have been in a theater with an audience who had no idea what was coming. Like, the one reveal and then the second reveal.
Well, sure, yeah. Both reveals.
You know, like
so here's my question. I know that, like, everybody talks about this as kind of the first horror movie. Is this the first movie with big, giant twist? Like, I'm trying to think of something that predates it where they just completely pull the rug out from under you.
I can't think of any, but it certainly... Whereas it's not the first horror film, it is the first modern horror film.
Sure, that's so what
we usher in the modern era.
Yeah.
I can't...
Let me tell you, actually.
Okay.
The earliest use of a device as a twist ending in a murder mystery was The Three Apples, a medieval Arabian Nights tale where the protagonist Jafar ibn Yahya discovers by chance a key item towards the end of the story that reveals a culprit behind the murder to have been his slave all along.
Oh, hey, spoiler, Kevin.
Oh, that was in my queue for this week. Yeah. I'm not even gonna watch it now.
Know all this stuff. I don't know.
But
what people
know. From a film standpoint, like, I mean, obviously there had been books and stuff that had done it, but I don't know that
this is a massive twist. Yeah, like this isn't like a gotcha. You know,
I mean,
if
it's not the first one, because there was, you know, 60 years of films before this, it was probably like. Like the first, like, big, like, commercial
right.
big one.
Yeah.
To the point where the warning was put in place that said, once this movie starts, you're not allowed into the theater. Like, we've said a billion times on this show is that the way movies were seen back then is people would just walk in and out of a theater willy-nilly.
Yeah.
And just sit down and just watch, till they caught up to where they were.
And if you think about it, they had to do that for two reasons. I mean, one, they want to protect the twist of the film, but also, if you walked in 40 minutes into this movie thinking you were going to a Janet Leigh movie,
right?
You'd think you were in the wrong movie, right? Like,
yeah,
you'd
totally.
Be like, where's
Absolutely.
Janet Leigh? Oh, I must be in the wrong. Now you're disrupting it because you're getting up and going to a different theater thinking you went to the wrong one. Like,
what a bunch of jerks.
Well, would you consider Citizen Kane, the ending of that? That's kind of a twist because you don't
know
what
like
that
this,
means.
Though. That's like a reveal.
Okay. That's true.
You know, like, I hear you.
Especially
because,
like, honestly, like, I love Citizen Kane, right? But that is one, like, to me, that's like such an anticlimactic reveal because you're just like, oh, wow, it's the sled. Well, what the God? Does that mean?
this one makes it very apparent what it
they
means.
Sent right, like, no. 2 years earlier. Vertigo,
maybe I don't know, man. Like that's even a stretch.
Yeah,
that's a Hitchcock thing, right? Though, right? Yeah. And then I that's why I love De Palma as much as I do. Mm-hmm. Like De Palma is very much body double is very much this. Movie.
Oh, sure.
It's this movie.
Yeah,
it's. I mean, it's the remake of Psycho that we kind of wanted. But you know.
So Sam is able to, before he kills Marion, he runs in and he's able to.
Well, yeah, that's the deal. Is the big reveal is that we see Norman in the dress.
Oh yeah, spoilers. Sorry, yeah, we didn't mention. Right. Yeah, Norman. Reveal. Norman is playing his mom.
But one
you ruined
of the
Greek
I
theater
in...
for us, but not this movie.
I know. is the way that Norman reacts as soon as Sam grabs him, like it's just I can't describe. It like the way his face twists, it's almost like he's switching personalities in front of us. Mm-hmm. But I think that's just Anthony Perkins doing something with that scene.
It's
so,
almost
yeah, so
like
then,
a stroke like in that
it is
just,
yeah totally.
And it could be that the two personalities, which are largely are able to live with one another within his mind, are suddenly like crash into one another, and uh-huh. His entire body can't reconcile that the two girlfriends that were never supposed to meet, you know, they met up,
right? And it's bad. I mean, trust me, in situations like that, it's bad news. Yeah, it's not doesn't go well.
I've never had two girlfriends in the same calendar year, let alone the same day. So this is news to me.
It's a good move, Tom. Yeah.
Was it?
I mean, fair enough.
Maybe not the same day, but, you know.
Yeah, right, yeah.
So he's apprehended, and we get
He's apprehended. We flash forward to the with the psychologist, who basically gives us the rundown as to why Norman was the way he was. Again,
this is one of my biggest complaints about Hitchcock movies, and I love Hitchcock.
The info dumps at the end?
Not even the info dumps, although that's lazy, but I also know it was forced on him. The studio was like, but what about dumb people? They like movies. Because he hated it and didn't want to do it. Nobody wanted it in there. They're mm-hmm. just, you know. But
it was what it was.
Yeah, but yeah. What I don't like about Hitchcock movies is, and he doesn't do it in all of them, but occasionally he does it, where he kind of delves into psychology, right? Mm-hmm. And it's like, we've learned so much since then that his you know supposedly educated psychological theories that kind of paint some of these movies, when they're really spelled out, you're just like, well, that's ludicrous. What's the one with the dreams that Salvador Dali did the designs for? It was very
I can't remember. I don't know. Salvador Dali did the designs for a Hitchcock movie?
He did. Yeah, they collaborated. Actually, Dali collaborated with both Hitchcock and with Walt Disney. So
yeah.
He got around. He, you know, he certainly...
Spellbound?
You know, yeah.
That's it.
I think it is Spellbound.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And,
Okay. Don't act so surprised, Ryan. I'm watching Kevin look up at his mind and he says it.
Doing the research.
Yeah. But, But yeah, so it, like, there's a lot of psychology kind of spelled out in that, and then like about how what dreams mean, and you're just like, well, this is dumb, like, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
you had me up until now,
right? It's a good movie, and it's great looking, and the dream scenes are really cool with all the Dolly stuff, but like at the same time, when they try to explain it like rationally, you're like,
right.
Shut up. Just stop.
Yeah, don't do that.
Just stop talking.
And he's just like, well, he does this, and it's because his mom did this.
But also, I think you'd have to argue, though, that at the time, I mean, because psychological issues were not considered the same that they are now. They're not taken as seriously. People aren't as caring about them. And it was really a big... like a kind of a scarlet letter, you know, if someone was openly had these issues, people would shy away instead of be more compassionate. And so at the time in 1960, to try to explain it away more so than, oh, he was a psycho killer murderer, like the psychologist is like, it wasn't Norman. It was actually a whole different personality. I think that for the time and for them to explain it like that is actually pretty neat and pretty innovative.
Yeah.
You can't really call him a transvestite, though.
Yeah.
That's not okay.
Well, but that's
one of those words
But he said he wasn't.
No, he said that he was.
Yeah.
No,
try to take it away from the sexual, because he's like, it's
right. Not. The sheriff makes that comment, and then the psychologist is like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Like, that's not.
For 1960,
yes, you're right.
Because in 1960, an uneducated, ignorant type of person, I mean, that people at that time, if a guy dresses up as a woman,
right.
a sheriff would have said, oh, that's a transvestite.
Yeah, they would have just looked at him and been like, them queers like to kill people.
Yeah, and so it's 1960, and the psychologist's like, no, actually, there's two personalities, and that was
super interesting because that ending is, it's kind of similar to Night of the Living Dead. Right, like Ben is the African American lead of that role, the hero of that entire movie, makes it the whole way through. Spoilers from Night of the Living Dead.
That's such a you don't want to spoil that if you've never seen it, because that's such a,
if you've never seen it, you're a problem with society.
Come on, we all have.
I didn't see it until 3 years ago. Remember?
Yeah.
Are you serious?
Yeah, when we did a Halloween episode, I'd never seen it.
Oh my gosh!
Man. Yeah,
so
and
fantastic.
It was really good. Like I did not. I was just like.
I'll
and
probably edit
like,
some of that out. That's such a big reveal. That's so good.
But it was really good.
Just put
a long
chicken noise over it.
Yeah.
But yeah, like it's on that level to me, right? Like it's just the way that they break down Norman. And it's weird, like you do the way that Anthony Perkins plays the character, as we'll get into in the next two, is there is a degree of vulnerability and likability to him that you're kind of rooting for him. Right, like not to kill anybody, but to,
Norman,
to be okay,
sure.
You know, and that's kind of the way it is with that other character that I mentioned from Night of the Living Dead.
So
then we do, we get that that forced explanation at the end, but then we do bring it back around to a great closing,
fantastic ending,
and just shot. So I like how we don't end with the explanation. Right. We actually get to end how Hitchcock wanted to. In the film, so it's like, oh, okay, I'll throw this in there, but we're gonna bring it back around.
Just staring at the camera is so creepy. That face
so
is
creepy.
Great, and then the whole "I wouldn't even hurt a fly,"
and then the smile,
it's so psychological.
Right? And that goes back to like the pliable face, like just the way he smiles in that scene is unnerving.
Yeah, iconic shot, and it's
very
a great
so.
Movie. It's a classic, and if you're not a horror person, I would say you still need to check this out, because again, most of the movie it's more of a mystery, and the horror stuff, it's not like in modern eyes you're gonna be like, oh my god, violence, I can't take it. Like it's
we get the shower scene, and
that's
there
it.
Really is one other violent act, so your body's anticipating, your mind's anticipating all these violent acts, when in fact you only get one other violent act in the film, which is the detective. And so I think it's a testament to horror isn't just violence and gore. I mean, schlock is fun, but there's a lot more to it than that. It is highly complex and very thoughtful. And it is a horror film. However, there's only two violent acts in the whole thing, but it's that suspension, you know, you're constantly anticipating the next violent act. And so when it does happen, it's really impactful.
It's heightened. Yeah.
That's
the horror that I like as someone that isn't a huge horror buff. The ones that I do like are the ones that are masterfully executed, with building up the tension, heightening it through not jump scares, but the music and the performances, and really making you wait for it and look for it around every corner. And all of a sudden, boom, it hits you and
it's a hot air balloon, right? Like that's what it is. That's to me, that's the formula for a good horror movie is you treat it like a hot air balloon where you build it, and then let a little bit out, and then you build it back, you know, and you just keep doing that until you reach the end.
I think the term that's used a lot today is prestige horror. And I'm not totally on board with the term itself, kind of like elevating. I hate it when people say elevating horror. It doesn't need to be elevated, but that's a whole other discussion.
Yeah.
But
especially
that is a
when look where
that,
it's, especially that, it doesn't need to be elevated when you look at where it started, right?
Yes.
Like this
it's
is
just
right.
that
this is pretty
progressive.
Elevated.
It's progressive. it's I mean, it's very diverse. We have leading female, strong female characters decades before other genres would catch up with that. And I love pointing that out to my students. Be like, this, it's an incredibly progressive genre, more so than any of the others.
It's just
so
because it fell into B movie slasher gore, you know, horror fell into something else. But
yeah.
Look at the movies we've talked about. When you talk about this movie, Rosemary's Baby, they started off very strong, and then they fell into the fun slasher gore B level stuff.
They fell into the stuff that made money,
right?
Lots of money.
But
but I will say, if you get the chance, I have the Shout Factory Blu-ray set, and it, like, watching this in HD, like, it is a gorgeous movie.
Yeah.
Seeing it in black and white, and just it's a beautifully remastered version. I'm sure the 60th anniversary will look just as good.
Well, that's better. It's 4K.
I'm sure that'll be in 4K.
Yeah. I watched.
I was reading a review of it, and people were saying that, like, it's so clear, like, you can even see, like, the fingerprints on the car from when people had opened and closed the door.
Oh, wow.
That's dope.
Yeah.
So there you go.
And this movie made a ton of money. The deal that Hitchcock cut because they didn't want him to make the movie, but he ended up...
Yeah, because it starts out as a Paramount film. He's working for Paramount. We associate his name with Universal because they end up buying Shamley Productions. But it was a Paramount picture, and they're like, this is going to flop. So we don't. It's just like, Paramount looks like you kind of screwed yourself over.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, like, instead of his regular $250,000, he did it for 60% of the gross, and so he ended up making $15 million. That's not adjusted. That's 1960. $15 million.
That's 1960 money?
Yeah, so adjusted for inflation, it would be, like, over $120 million would have been his take.
That dude was loaded.
That's it. Yeah, game over. I'd be like, I'm out.
$100 million from one movie profit? Like, that's...
I got nothing left.
Yeah. Wow. So... And I also think there's one other little interesting first that this movie does. It's the first major movie to show a toilet flush.
Yes.
So.
Yeah.
Interesting.
They actually had to, like, she tears up the note and flushes it, and they wrote it in that way so they couldn't, it was integral to the plot, and they couldn't cut out the toilet flush.
There you go.
You had to see the note go away, so just thought that was...
I don't want to delve too far, but touching on that with, like, her and Sam are unmarried, but they're fooling around in bed. Was this, like, an early example of that, or was that okay, like, in movies to show two unmarried?
They were definitely, like, smooching and making out.
Right.
Too. Commercially, it was considered very edgy for the time.
Yeah.
You would have it in other films, but in terms of big commercial, like Hitchcock, you know, huge name. Mm-hmm. He was also a huge individual, but he was a huge name.
And this movie has been, so the MPAA didn't rate movies in the traditional sense back then. And so over the years, this movie has been submitted for ratings repeatedly, and it has been given a PG, a PG-13, and an R at different points in time.
I absolutely believe that.
And it was, I mean, it didn't premiere on network television for like 10 or 11 years.
Was it the 1980s?
I thought it was the 70s. I read that it was supposed to premiere like in the late 60s, and then like a senator's daughter or something got stabbed, and then they were just maybe this isn't about
Never mind.
And then and so it kicked the can down the road a little bit, and I thought it didn't premiere on television until like 71 or 72, which, I mean, you know, talk about theatrical release windows.
With 100% of the share. on whatever channel it was.
Oh, yeah.
It was on. Like, nothing. You know, I was like, granted, you had three channels.
You know, people don't know. Like, people don't really remember, like when a big movie like that would premiere on network television back then, it was a big deal. Like, I mean, the first time, you know, one of those movies would pop up on TV, like, I mean, it had been a lot of times 4 or 5 years since it had been in theaters. It would take a long time
to make
that journey.
No home video, none of that stuff.
Yeah, so I mean, I remember when a major motion picture was on network TV, man, like that was a big deal, and especially when it made its premiere, it's just as I get older and more removed from that, I'm like, man, like I'm kind of on the younger end of people who remember that time frame of like,
for sure.
Oh my God, Smokey and the Bandit is going to finally be on TV, and it's like where now it's just It's on your phone 3 minutes after it hits theaters, you know?
Yeah, right, right. Yeah.
So, well, I guess...
Yeah, this is a classic flick. I can't recommend
it. Yeah, I think the gold standard for a movie like this is when you can show it to a 14 and a 16-year-old and they're still into it and not complaining. I feel like that says a lot. So,
definitely.
But, totally agree. Absolutely.
Well, I
definitely.
Guess that's it for this one. Let's go around the virtual table and everyone can say where to find them.
This is Joe. You can follow me on the Twitter at JoeyButts, BUTTS21.
This is Kevin. Follow me on Twitter at KevinRBracket.
And Ryan, where can everyone find you?
Everybody can find me at RLTerry1 on Twitter. And you can follow my fictional show, radio, however you guys described it in the last show.
New old time radio.
Forza Crowd at Forza Crowd Pod. So my personal one is RLTerry1, but you can follow my podcast, Forza Crowd Pod, on Twitter as well.
And we'll try to get Amazon to make that into a movie for you.
Yeah, but hopefully a better one. And then you can find me on Twitter at Roger Kubert or on Facebook at facebook.com/Tom O'Keefe. You can find the show online, facebook.com/Real Spoilers. While you're there, like the page, join the group, and of course, don't forget our Patreon, patreon.com/Real Spoilers. So that's it for this one. Coming up for the next one, Ryan will return to help us discuss Psycho 2 and 3. Until then, you've been warned.
Get ready for a spoiler. Won't say it twice because we already warned you.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.